Entrepreneur Weekly interviews the brilliant leaders of today in order to provide a stepping stone of wisdom on the journey to personal business ownership. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
Well, you know, part of my job, I travel the world talking to entrepreneurs. Earlier this week, I was in China, in Shanghai and Beijing. I met some amazing people, saw an amazing country, and I'm back to talk about a little bit of it here today and to also make sure I weave it into the conversations that I have on this show. Our first guest today, hopefully this will work out a little bit for him, is Noah Glass. He is the founder and CEO of Olo, OLO.com on the web, OLO.com. Olo, by the way, has just announced a partnership with Uber Eats. It's an interface between restaurants and the on-demand world. And Noah is an industry visionary whose mobile ordering predates the iPhone. Whew. So all the way back to 2005. Welcome to the show, Noah. Thanks for joining us. And I got to tell you, I was in China, and this motorcycle goes right by, and there was a big box on the back, and the guide that was with us, I go, look at that guy, he's crazy. And he goes, because he's got hot food, basically, is what he said. He's delivering food, you know? And I went, oh my gosh, you know, this is crazy. And in China, it's like, it's wild. I walked by one thing, and there was like, I thought were tarantulas on a stick. Turned out to be they were little crabs. But, I mean, there's every kind of food you can imagine. And, yes, it's all being delivered all over the place on bicycles and motorcycles and cars. And so, yeah, it's a whole other thing. And I actually want to try and weave that into this conversation because it's so top of mind for me. But welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about Olo beyond what I already did.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for having me on the show. And, yeah, I'd love to come back to China. Really fascinating kind of vision of the future, I think, and where everything is going in terms of restaurants and digital ordering and food delivery. I'll tell you a bit about Olo. We are the largest digital ordering and delivery enablement platform for the restaurant industry in the U.S. That means that we're a software platform that restaurants use to let their consumers order and pay and then skip the line at the restaurant to get their food faster or to get food delivered to them. I started the company in June of 2005. We're now up to over 70,000 restaurants across the country and some in Canada that use Olo to provide their digital ordering and delivery experience. That's across over 300 enterprise restaurant brands. And if you look at the public restaurant brands kind of as a proxy for our coverage of that side of the market, we now have over half of the public brands using the Olo platform for digital ordering and delivery enablement. These are brands that are household names, brands like Applebee's, Cheesecake Factory, Denny's, brands like Shake Shack, Sweetgreen, Wingstop, and 300 more. But really the ideas around the whole economy shifting towards on-demand commerce and enabling restaurants to be available to consumers in this on-demand fashion. So the consumer can order through their digital device. The food is ready and waiting when they get there, or they never have to even go there. The food just magically comes to them. There's a massive shift that's happening in the restaurant industry now where analysts are predicting that by the end of 2022, over $200 billion is going to shift towards digital ordering and delivery in an $800 billion industry. So that's 25 cents of every restaurant dollar. To put that in perspective, that's more than all of the sales of all of the drive-thrus combined. And the drive-thru has had an over 40-year history to get to that kind of market share. So this is a seismic shift happening in the industry. And we view our role at Olo as helping our restaurant customers not just survive that shift, but really thrive and be the best position for a future where consumers are looking to have on-demand experiences from the restaurants they love.
I got to tell you, I love it, and I love your story. We'll take a little break. When we come back, you guys probably know me by now. I like underdogs. Noah Glass, an underdog. He decided not to go to Harvard Business School after being offered seed money for Olo from an investor. Decided not to go to Harvard Business School. I love that. And now, leading the way. I'm Alan Taylor. This is Entrepreneur Weekly. We're going to hear the rest of his story on the other side. Don't go anywhere.
Stay tuned. There's more Entrepreneur Weekly after these messages.
I knew that I would too. Welcome back. It is Entrepreneur Weekly. Entrepreneurs are a different breed of human being. They're people that see a problem and want to come up with a solution. Kind of the, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. Noah Glass is one of those people. He had a chance to go to Harvard Business School, and somebody came along and said, you know what? Let's fund this thing and make it happen. And today they're pretty much kicking butt. By the way, I notice here, named one of the 50 most influential people in food service in 2017 and 18, Nation's Restaurant News Power List, and has been recognized by Business Week and Business Insider for his contributions in shaping the restaurant industry. I love that, man. That is just cool. And, you know, for a moment, the United States has really wonderful standards, okay? But I just came back from China. What do you do in China when you have just a little hole in the wall, or the pot burning over a flame, and somebody making soup? I mean, how small and how large do you have to be to use Olo? Olo.com on the web if you want to see more about Noah Glass. But, I mean, what are you going to do worldwide? Are you already worldwide?
So it's really interesting to think about the global opportunity for what we're doing. I mean, a lot of what our focus has been in the United States is really around enterprise restaurant groups that have the same menu across many different restaurant locations. That's really how we designed our platform. That kind of mix of restaurants in the enterprise segment is really high in the U.S. It's about half of the 600,000 restaurants. So about 300,000 restaurants fall under that category of Olo's target market, these enterprise restaurant brands we work with. In other parts of the world, it is far fewer restaurants that are in the enterprise restaurant category.
Right.
Speaking of China, the last time I looked at it, it was something like 6 million restaurants, so 10 right. times the number of restaurants. But if you look at the number of those that are enterprise restaurants by that same definition, it's something like 180,000.
Right.
So there's still a lot of restaurants, but it's about 3% of the total population of restaurants. So we really start to think about how do we scale down the Olo platform that's really designed for enterprise restaurant brands and still bring that same value proposition of enabling restaurants to be available to consumers in an on-demand fashion for independent restaurants or small chain restaurants. And also these days, how do we help restaurants manage all the different sources of orders? There are orders that are coming from a restaurant's own app and own website, and that's what restaurants are putting a premium on. And then there are orders coming from third-party delivery marketplaces, these indirect sales channels. And when you were in China, I'm sure you saw Meituan or LMA. These are the two big, giant restaurant delivery marketplace companies. They are capturing the consumer and the consumer information and sending those orders from their platform into the restaurants. They're then filling the order. And then those services, Meituan and LMA, send their delivery couriers to collect the order at the restaurant and deliver it to the guest wherever they are. It's really interesting to see that playing out in the U.S. with the large delivery marketplaces here, Uber Eats, who we just announced a partnership with, DoorDash, Postmates, Grubhub. These are all big players, all fighting for market share, for who's going to be the largest platform that consumers choose to go to and order from their favorite restaurants. And I think restaurants have a lot to offer, too, of enabling consumers to order directly from them and still get a high-quality delivery experience or pickup experience at the restaurant.
You know what's funny? I'm listening to you talk, and I'm coming back to you decided not to go to the Harvard Business School, but you went to the Harvard Business School of Hard Knocks, and brother, you could probably be a professor. Listen to you. Is this bizarre to you that all of a sudden it's like, you know, when somebody says, where's your plaque on the wall? Where is it? You're like, nah. This is called hard work and experience, right?
Well, it was fun. I got to go to Harvard Business School earlier this year where they did a case study about Olo and specifically around a product called Dispatch that we released about 3 years ago in the delivery space, what I was just talking about. And at the end of the class, the professor, Michael Kaufman, said, you know, we have a little something for you. And I thought he was going to give me a diploma, but instead he just gave me a baseball cap and a nice pad of paper that had the Harvard Business School insignia. So I guess that's my plaque on the wall. But I like the fact that they kind of I didn't wind up going, but they were interested in hearing what I'd been up to for the last 14 years and had me come and talk to the students there.
I love it, man. I love it. To me, honestly, your plaque, it's like it's probably pictures of your wife and kids. That's way more important. We're going to take a break. Noah Glass is with us, founder and CEO of Olo, olo.com. When we come back, we're going to ask him to be the Harvard School of Hard Knocks professor on this show. It is Entrepreneur Weekly.
Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer.
Can't get enough of Entrepreneur Weekly? Check out our podcast on iTunes for even more content. Subscribe today. You're listening to Entrepreneur Weekly. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
Well, the guy on the phone, his name is Noah Glass. He's the founder and CEO of Olo, an interface between restaurants and on-demand world for ordering food. This guy he's done amazing things, and he did not go to Harvard Business School. Now, oddly enough, I didn't either, which doesn't mean, you know, really amount to a hill of beans in the world to... If you want to go, go. But I didn't go. I was working. I was just working. I had wife and kids, and I didn't go. But all of a sudden, I've been asked to be the co-chair of the Harvard Business School Person of the Year. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll go and do that. Noah didn't go, but he's a case study for them of how to do things right. I love that, man. All right, so the School of Hard Knocks, not called Harvard, but perhaps even more important, I'd love to get some advice from you. So you were faced with starting a business because you just know your stuff, or at least you feel like you do, and whoever had the money at the time said, I'm betting my money on Noah. Or go to Harvard Business School and walk out with a diploma, and you could say, I know my stuff because I went to Harvard. But you took the road less traveled. In that particular case, you said, you know what? I got a hunch that I can do this. So I want to start right there and walk forward from there. You're in that spot where you can either do that or take the money and start a business. What was that like for you?
I wish I could say I deliberated for a long time. It was a difficult decision. It really wasn't like that. For me, I remember it being just a knee-jerk reaction of, yes, this is the time in my life, and yes, this is the time in the world for this idea that smartphones are about to hit and become ubiquitous. I've got to jump on this, and I will always regret it if I don't jump on this. So it was that quick for me. Awesome. Where I knew that the answer was, yeah, that makes sense. I'm going to move forward with this. I'll give a ton of credit to David Frankel, who is my seed investor and now the principal at Founder Collective in Boston. You know, what he said to me, having himself been an entrepreneur and then going to Harvard Business School to become an investor, you know, he said, I believe in you, and on that basis, I'm going to back you and give you the seed investment to get this started. But here's what I need from you. I need to know that you have enough conviction in this, that you're willing to quit your job, and that you're willing to withdraw from Harvard Business School. If you can do that, then I will support you and I'll give you the seed money. And that was a huge gift. The seed money was a huge gift, yes. But the asking me, do you have the conviction in this enough to burn the boats? Do you have the conviction in this enough to make this your only path forward where you have to fight to survive? That was a real gift. It gave me focus. It gave me clarity. It made me laser focused on making this a success. And there are tough times in any entrepreneurial journey where you can imagine saying, you know, life's too short. I'm just going to stop this. I'm going to go off to school, and that's what I'm going to do. I burnt those boats. I didn't have those luxuries of having an alternative path. And that really made all the difference. It wasn't just the path less traveled. It was the path that I was on and felt like I was going to make work or go down with the ship. And that was a real gift for me.
So in 1519 AD, during the Spanish conquest of Mexico, they obviously had boats and they went to a battle, and the captain or the general, whoever he was, said, burn the boats after they all got ashore because they had nowhere to retreat to. They have to win the battle. If you don't know what that is, just Google burn the boats. It pops right up. I didn't want to waste all your time on telling that story. It's a fantastic story, but it boils down to this. We either win this war or we're going to die. And that's the way it is sometimes in life, and in business especially. You've got to just burn the boats and charge ahead with everything you got. I love the fact that you seek that sage advice from the guy that was giving you the money. That's not always where it comes from, as you know. Some people that have money, you know, got it, inherited it, or in charge of it. That guy gave you good advice, and that is awesome, and it's a rare thing. And so let me ask you now, what's next?
Well, what's next is more Olo. What's next for me is I've been doing this for 14 years. I could do this for another 28 years, another 42 years, as long as they will let me keep doing it. In fact, that investor is still on my board of directors. I've got a great supportive group of investors. We are in the super, super early innings of what is a massive shift in the restaurant industry. And I think if you zoom out, it's really about the retail industry. When I first started thinking about this, I thought restaurants are first, not restaurants are the only place where this is going to work. I thought restaurants are that kind of everyday transaction where being able to buy something from your phone, from a local shop, have it ready when you get there or delivered to you same hour is a big idea for restaurants, and it's an everyday transaction type. But I'll tell you, I think that every local retailer that is right now in an existential fight for its life and thinking about the pressures on it from e-commerce competitors is thinking, you know, if I could compete on convenience, if I could let my local customers order something from me and get it delivered same hour, now all of a sudden, because of my local advantage, I'm more convenient than my e-commerce competition. And that's really where I see the future being for Olo. We're laser focused on the restaurant industry, but some of the work that we're doing around delivery, I think, transcends the restaurant industry into the broader $5 trillion retail market. And that's just in the U.S. There's also a massive international opportunity.
Right.
We have a lot of vectors of growth, and we're excited to explore them all. And we're just getting started.
Three letters, O-L-O. What does it stand for? Quick.
Online ordering.
Oh, too easy. Noah Glass, founder and CEO, Olo.com. Thank you, Noah. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Another good entrepreneur. We'll be right back.
Discover unstoppable industry influencers who celebrate disruptive thinking and game-changing business strategies on Entrepreneur Weekly. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
You know, it's funny. There's such a huge business on Amazon these days. Who would have ever thought? Who would have ever thought? And there's people that make a lot of money on Amazon. Our next guest is John Rossman. He used to be an executive at Amazon, and he is now the author of the book, Think Like Amazon, 50 and a half ideas to become a digital leader. And first of all, I understand you pulled out before such times as Amazon stock went completely bonkers. And so you're kind of a regular guy again. You're not like the ultra wealthy guy that we see on the 100-foot yacht out in Monaco. And where'd you make your money? Oh, Amazon stock. I have friends that sold Apple stock. They bought it really low and they sold it really high at like $100, you know. And so it's like if you stay in, you know, for the long haul, you can make tremendous amount of money. But a lot of people, you know, it's like, how do you know when it's going to be high? And sometimes you don't. But, you know, maybe your gold mine is this book. I hope it will be, John. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. You know, thanks for setting me back already on my therapy and everything. But, yeah, you know, I think what everybody remembers is kind of from a stock standpoint is just the past 8-9 years where the Amazon stock has just done nothing but go up and to the right. But there right. there was about a 9-year period before that where the stock was essentially flat. And I was in a 4-year period kind of right in the middle of that. And great company, had a lot of fun, work extremely hard. But at some point, you just kind of lose patience. And I had a great opportunity to go be a partner in a consulting firm. And I've never looked back. But yeah, nobody saw this coming. And I think that's kind of maybe the first, you know, lesson from Amazon is you got to be patient to let the customer evolve, let the business evolve, stick with the things you believe. And sometimes it takes a lot longer than one might imagine.
You know, it's funny. And as I'm looking here, I always get crib notes of usually I don't really read all of them because there's so much. But dude, you've worked with the likes of the Gates Foundation, Microsoft, Nordstrom, Target, Walmart, and many others. I mean, those are some big companies. So what is it you do? And then I want to get into the book, but what is it you guys do for these companies?
Yeah, so I advise companies and leaders, and typically it's about taking a concept, an idea, a strategy, and like how do we really operationalize it? How do we really make it come to fruition, and giving some independent energy and governance to those types of capabilities? So that's typically what I do with big companies, and that's kind of half my business. And then the other half of my business is I go out and I give a lot of keynotes to audiences, and I work with leadership teams just about kind of digital strategy and the leadership and the principles that are needed to be successful at it.
Woo-hoo. Did you work very closely with Bezos?
I did, yeah. Especially the first year I was there when we were defining and launching the marketplace, I had a weekly meeting with what's called the S team, but really that's a one-on-one meeting with Jeff. And it was a lot of fun. He expected you to understand your business extremely well. So he had a very high bar in terms of what he expected. But I mean, they were about getting things done, and he was a tremendous partner in helping to get through issues, through any blockers that were in the way, and getting things done.
So if I could ask you,
I made a couple of trips with him to go see some enterprise clients and stuff. So yeah,
nice.
I did.
Right. So yeah. If, you know, and I want to get to your book, but I like to do a little groundwork here.
Sure.
What was the one takeaway for dealing with a guy like Jeff Bezos, who started in a garage like many other entrepreneurs? But the one takeaway that you, it always kind of bubbles up, that you respect, even if you hate his guts for the guy that he is, but you respect this about him. What is this?
The thing I learned most in dealing with him is you need to be able to clearly explain the idea, the concept of the issue, and then have data to back it up to explain it, right?
Right.
And so it was always this combination of being able to easily and make it simple to understand, and then the data behind it. And then you better be able to follow up with, well, this is what we're doing about it. These are the reasons. He's a very root cause oriented problem solver. So what's really behind the issue, and how do you truly get to the root fix? You know, one of the things I took away from him is, I mean, he's just a problem solver. He's a roll up his sleeves. Truly, when he's curious about something, which is a lot of things, he really wants to understand it, and he just wants to participate in making something happen. Mm-hmm. And so there was no pretentiousness about it, and you just had to be prepared and understand your business well.
You know, it's funny. I have learned more so recently than any other time in my life that I'm a problem solver. And what happens is that in my own pride of saying that I'm a problem solver, I'll say that, and then people bring me their problems, right? And I usually get paid to solve problems. That's my business. But then when my people bring me their problems, it's like I try to solve their problems. But when my employees bring me their problems, I need to be able to differentiate between, hey, you need to deal with that on your own, or let's talk about that after hours. I need to separate myself, because then I become a problem solver, and more like a psychiatrist than a businessman. It's like, this is, entrepreneurs do this. And we fall in love with ourselves a little bit, our ability to solve problems. So we get off track. We get sidetracked by trying to solve problems that aren't the core of what we do for a living. And all of a sudden, yeah, we're solving problems, but we're not solving our own problems. We're creating problems. Oh, my God. That was a weird tangent, but I think it meant something.
Well, no, but I think especially with employees or colleagues, and it's kind of like how you deal with your kids when they're at a mature age and everything, is that if they do bring you a situation, a problem, the best approach is always just by asking them questions, right, versus coming up with an answer. And if you can lead somebody to what the right answer is, they not only get to the right answer, but then they have better tools to deal with something like that in the future and stuff. And so, and especially if you don't understand the details of the circumstances, figuring out what questions to ask to help them solve it for themselves is, you know, an extremely powerful and safe technique to help others solve their own problems. And then they're better equipped to do it for themselves in the future.
Yeah, no, this is very interesting. And it's mainly because for right now in my life, I find that I'm having to deal with all kinds of problems that are not business related. And they are on me, whether it be the fact that I have really super aged parents. My mom and dad are 91 and 88, and I'm having to solve all kinds of problems over there. I got grandkids. I got kids. I got kids that live with, you know, my friends and my kids. And I'm all of a sudden, I've turned into a psychiatrist. I need a psychiatrist. You're talking about your therapist. I need one. I need to get back on track. A lot of us entrepreneurs need to do that. Stay with the core of what you do. Hold on, don't go anywhere. Take a break. We're going to get run over. It is Entrepreneur Weekly. Whether you have a great idea you want to launch or a business you're running that you want to grow, Woman Entrepreneur's powerful Build Like a Woman curriculum of online courses gives you all the tools you need to take your business to the next level. From digital self-paced courses, virtual coaching sessions, and webinars with experts, we power the entire journey, arming women entrepreneurs and leaders with what they need to start, grow, and flourish. Get started today. It's free to start. Enroll now at entrepreneur.com/courses. Again, that's entrepreneur.com/courses. Well, it's a perfect song to come back with. Girls just want to have fun. You know, I mean, we all want to have fun in business. This is Entrepreneur Weekly radio show. I mean, being an entrepreneur is supposed to be fun. What happens is we're so busy solving everybody else's problem. I just flew to China. And the first thing they tell you is, you know, if there's an emergency, put your own oxygen mask on first before you help somebody else. And that's so true also in business. You got to make sure that you've got your own life straightened out before you're helping everybody else. And what happens is sometimes because I'm an entrepreneur, I'm so busy helping everybody else straighten out their lives that I let my own crash to the ground. So just to finalize that last thought, I want to get to John Rossman and his book, Think Like Amazon, 50 and a Half Ideas to Become a Digital Leader. So, John, why did you write this book? What's the crux of it?
Yeah, what a great question. So as you mentioned, I've gotten to work with a ton of great companies and leaders since I've left Amazon. And I just got good at taking the little anecdotes, the little strategies from Amazon and inserting them into my client to help them make change happen, right, to get to some successful outcome. And I had one client in particular at the Gates Foundation, a guy by the name of Greg Shaw. And Greg pulled me into his office one day and said, John, you know, you really ought to capture all these little ideas and write them into a book. And this was several years after I left Amazon. And so I said, great. And Greg has quite a bit of book development background. He helped Bill Gates with his two books. And so I set about writing Think Like Amazon. And again, it's the book's not about Amazon. It's about you and some things you can borrow from Amazon to help get the types of results that they're experiencing.
All right. You talk about of all of Bezos' management notions, perhaps the most distinctive is his belief that harmony is often overvalued in the workplace. What? Why disagreement, not consensus, often a better path to innovation? Give me that one.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're thinking about solving a hard problem, coming up with something new, doing something that is non-obvious, right? That's what innovation is about, is getting a new approach to something that is a hard problem. trying to get to consensus on something typically isn't going to lead you to a great idea. You have to be willing to challenge each other and put getting the right idea as the highest priority. You want to do that in a collaborative way. You want to do that in a friendly and effective way. But you can't make that the top priority. And so a lot of the things that Amazon does is just to put in the right order. We need to be right, and we need to have the right idea and execute correctly about it and prize that more than being collaborative in the organization. So things like having the right metrics, always shooting for root cause understanding in situations, starting with the customer and working backwards. Those are simply kind of strategies that help you put getting to the right answer above being collaborative in the organization. And if something has to slide, you know, sometimes holding each other accountable, being argumentative relative to getting to the right idea, that's what it takes. That's the struggle that it takes to get to an innovative idea.
You said holding each other, like hugging. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right.
Oftentimes inappropriately.
There you go. I'm going to just say a couple things. Give me like 30 seconds on something like this. Move fast and break things.
So I think that, you know, Facebook really revolutionized that term. I don't think they envisioned breaking our democracy when they were talking about that. But really the notion behind that is how to be agile, how to quickly have a hypothesis, a guess as to what the right thing to do is, do a prototype to test it, get the right data, learn from it, and then adjust, right? That is the agile mindset, the minimally viable product techniques. And so one of the ideas, I think it's idea 17, experiment, fail, rinse, repeat, is all about this notion of how to create incremental hypotheses, test those, and iterate. And I think the term failure gets inserted a lot into this conversation. And the type of failure that we're talking about here is really the scientific learning process of creating an experiment, testing, quote unquote failing, which just means learning, and then adjusting. And that's the type of failure that we're shooting for in this move fast and break things notion.
Give me 30 seconds on the power of being misunderstood, literally.
So the power of being misunderstood is all about having an insight that unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, either way, breaks a commonly held conception or assumption or business approach. And being willing to stick to your guns and being willing to be misunderstood over a long period of time. And Bezos always says, like, you know, if you're going to be innovative, for heaven's sakes, you better be ready to be misunderstood. Because so oftentimes the innovation goes against the ingrained traditional business practice.
Mm. This is called Dazed and Confused. 50 and a half ideas to become a digital leader. The book, Think Like Amazon. We're talking about, oh my gosh, How to Think Like Amazon, John Rossman. We'll be right back with more.
Wanted a woman, never bargained for you. Lots of people talking, few of them know. Soul of a woman.
Stay tuned. There's more Entrepreneur Weekly after these messages. Listening to Entrepreneur Weekly. Now, here's your host, Alan Taylor.
Well, we're talking with John Rossman. He is the author of Think Like Amazon, 50 and a half ideas to become a digital leader. He has worked with many, Microsoft, Nordstrom, Target, Walmart, the Gates Foundation, and Jeff Bezos himself. Here he is. So let me ask you, what is the half idea? 50 and a half. I'm just curious.
I'll tease it a little bit, but really, as I said, this book isn't about Amazon. It's about you as a leader and how are you going to be more innovative? How are you going to be more effective? How are you going to create a more disciplined organization? And so the half idea is really like, hey, these are the authentic things that Amazon does in different circumstances. But the real question is, what are you willing to do differently? And so the half idea basically puts it back to the reader about what are you personally willing to change, create a new skill, allocate your time differently? What are you willing to do differently to get a different outcome?
So it's actually brilliant. Because everybody's looking for the self-help book, but they want to copy somebody, which is nothing wrong with that. It's the highest form of flattery is to copy somebody. Nothing wrong with that at all. But at some point, even if you copy somebody, there are certain sacrifices you have to make as a human being, choices that you have to make. So, John Rossman, author of Think Like Amazon, 50 and a half ideas to become a digital leader. Let me just change that. It could be 50 and a half ideas to become a leader, because that's what you have to first seek, is what you want to do. And I think as an entrepreneur, you have to be the leader. So how do you help people over that hump? There's changes we need to make. Mine for all my whole life has always been, I'm too heavy and I want to lose weight. I can lose weight. I can will myself to lose weight, and then it's right back on again. I get on the scale this morning. I said to my wife, I've gained 10 pounds back. She's like, what? Because I worked so hard to lose 20 pounds. I'm halfway back in a matter of weeks. But I have not made those sacrifices. How, John, do you help people in your book or in your life to learn how to have more discipline? Isn't that the word?
It is. I mean, especially in the business context, especially small teams, because they're used, they understand things, they think so well, they skip over the really important habit, the discipline of creating great operational and great customer experience metrics. And then as a team, consistently reviewing those metrics, and they don't realize that that's the daily work. That's the going to the gym work that you need to do every day to build the insights on both how am I going to improve something, the operational excellence component, as well as how could I innovate. All leaders want is the outcome, right? Like, we want the big moment to ring the bell to cross the finish line, but it's really the everyday habits of the discipline of measuring every little thing you can in your business and then struggling to understand, how can I improve it? How do I avoid the errors? How do I shrink the costs? How do I shorten the cycle times? All of those operational excellent components. And that is the backbone of Amazon's innovation and culture, is metrics and operational excellence.
And that is their discipline. And that's why they do so well.
That is. It really is. I think Bezos has said something like 90% of all Amazon innovations at its heart comes from operational excellence. Mm.
So along the way, what is the one thing that you look back and remember about Jeff Bezos? I mean, I'm just curious. Is there one little thing you wish you could have said this? You wish you would have done that differently? I mean, you were an executive at Amazon. That was a big deal. You stepped away. Now, you're probably doing great in your life. You're an author. You got all this going on. But do you have any regrets?
Well, I mean, nobody saw this coming. And so I really don't, because I'm still married and I have two great kids, and I got to be a real active partner through that. And I think that would have been a challenge given the pace that we were keeping at Amazon and everything. And so I don't suffer from looking back and like, just imagine if I hadn't quit and everything. So I've been so blessed in both the work I get to do as well as everything else. So not really, but I think when I look back, the one thing I think about and I recognize is how patient the environment was to build a business. We were impatient for everyday results and for, you know, driving to get things implemented, but Amazon is patient about letting them business mature.
Yep. I love it. Beautiful. I love the fact that you don't have any regrets, and your family is the value that you walk away with, that you're, even if you could have been a multi-jillionaire, you look back and go, you know what? I got my family. That's priceless. Right?
And it's a hypothetical. Like, why drive yourself nuts with a hypothetical?
That's exactly right. RossmanPartners.com. John Rossman, you did a great job. Thank you, sir.
Alan, thanks for having me.
All great right. Music. That's about it for me this week. And I'm going to ramble on. See you guys all next week.
This program is copyrighted by Entrepreneur Media Incorporated.